Well, good morning, everyone. We are talking about the section, Judge Not Lest You Be Judged. And maybe a good way to think about this in the context of the Sermon on the Mount, think back to the beginning of chapter 6, where we're talking about almsgiving and prayer and fasting. And remember, the concern that our Lord raises with all three of those things is hypocrisy, or in other words, or vanity, that you are doing things to be seen. Don't do this to be seen. You do it that way, you already have your reward. You should be doing it in a way in which your Father in heaven rewards you. Remember, you're talking about an age in which fasting, prayer, and almsgiving are kind of status things to do. These are things that you do that people admire, and because they're part of the law and the social codes that everybody accepts. I say that because is praying publicly, is that somehow going to increase your status? Even in church, if you're the person who you are staying after in church and praying, you're like going to one of the side altars. It could be the people at church will look at you like, "What? It's over. What's the matter with her?" Right? It's over. What's gotten into him? And in fact, if you have you're in church, you're still trying to pray, Mass is over, and you have people right next to you. Yep, 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 yep. And you even kind of look in the direction. It's like, hey, don't look at me. Church is over. We're time to visit. You know, don't be so loosen up. You are too uptight. So there are all sorts of these things that are true in our Lord's time 2,000 years ago that they aren't as true now. It could be that you actually are taking a little bit of a status hit when you publicly pray. It could be you are taking a bit of a status hit if you're fasting. If you were slimming to get into a new bikini size or something like that for spring break, okay, that's reasonable. But like somehow you're fasting every day of Lent, right? That's weird. Almsgiving is fine. Again, if you've got a check, like you're standing at one end of the check and the foundation is standing at the other end of the check, you grip and grin, as a journalist friend of mine called it. That makes sense. Being generous, I guess, and there's forms of generosity that make sense. But again, there are a number of these things that in our Lord's time, you are in danger of seeking status doing them. And if anything, for a number of these things, we're kind of at the opposite. Nonetheless, the thing that's common between what you're hearing at the beginning of 6 and what's going on here in Judge Not Lest You Be Judged, that the principle that connects them is understanding things from the exterior versus the interior, and the importance of the interior. Okay? Very often, when we're functioning socially, certainly politically, I'll talk about that in a minute, we have to work in a world of exteriors. We have to work in a world of what we can see and express and verify and give evidence for. But if we're talking now about whether or not you're a morally good person, even from just a natural point of view, let alone from a supernatural point of view, we're talking about something that's going on the inside that is not easy to verify or know. And in fact, quite frankly, it can be tough for us to know ourselves. It can be tough for us to be honest with ourselves about our own motivations or our own reason. There's a wonderful movie I saw years ago, and I just saw it because I was in college and I was bored and there was nothing else to watch. Most of the time I ended up watching bad movies for that reason, but this was actually a good movie. It was called The Red Tent, and it was about this expedition to the North Pole. And it involved a number of folks. One was Italian, Bernardo Nobile, I think, was the main person. And then there was a Scandinavian guy, Amundsen, who tries to rescue him. And they're explorers in the North Pole. They're trapped. They're in a storm. And eventually this plane makes it through. And Roberto Di Nobile gets on the plane, and he has the expectation that the other guys will be able to be rescued, and then a storm comes in and wipes out the rest of the expedition. And the movie starts with him in old age, and the ghosts of the men who he lost in this expedition are coming to visit, and he just revisits this all over again. And at the so after the kind of narration of how the events unfolded, one of the ghosts says to him, "Okay, there were a dozen reasons to stay, and there were a dozen reasons to leave. Why do you think you did it? When you were in the plane, what were you thinking of?" And you see the plane taking off from the ice floes. "I was thinking of a hot bath in Spitsbergen." So this guy has been haunted for the whole of his life because he realizes that although there were all sorts of good reasons to leave, just like there were good reasons to stay, there was like his personal comfort. That really was what got him, and now that haunts him for the rest of his life. So, but that was something at the time he probably, if you had called him on it, he would have been completely defensive about it and denied it. And it's only something with years that he's come to be honest with himself. This is why it is that I'm so haunted by this, because I realize the reason I left was a purely self-seeking one. So it's difficult to make judgments about other people. It's difficult to make judgments of our about even ourselves. In chapter 6, he's making it clear that as best as you are able, you need to be giving alms, fasting, praying, not for the reason of impressing others, not for show, not for vanity. And now what we're talking about here is when you are looking at others, you need to avoid making judgments. You need to be aware that you don't have the knowledge of hearts. You need to focus on the reform of your own heart more than make judgments about other people's hearts. Because again, in terms of moral goodness, there are things that you can say about the outside, but that ultimate principle is what's happening on the inside. Even when your kids are naughty, you probably undergo some kind of discussion with them because you're trying to figure out how much did you know and how much did you understand? Was this just clueless or were you just flat out rebelling against me, kid? You're trying to figure that out because you're going to go a little easier on the kid if it was cluelessness as opposed to, no, this kid really was, this is just pride. This is just, I know better, you don't, I'm doing it my way. I thought a helpful place to start is the realm of judgment that we all recognize as necessary, and that's in the political realm, in the legal realm. We can't have a functioning society unless there are areas of human action that we recognize are bad, and now we restrict people's behavior, and when they don't follow those rules, they get punished. Okay, this is the law, by the way, so we don't talk about consequences. We say punish. Everybody goes to jail. We recognize that's not just, those are the consequences for your action, young man. No, you're punishing people when you send them to jail, when you find them, and so on. So one of the articles from St. Thomas that I think is helpful is where he contrasts the divine law to the human law. And basically, the discussion is, why is it that we need a divine law? We've got a natural law written on the hearts. We have laws that we make is in community, that we make as cities and states and nations. So why do we need a divine law? And St. Thomas gives four reasons, and I'm going to focus on one of them, but it's good to hear all three, or all four. So first, we are ordered to a supernatural end. We're ordered to union with God. So of course there are things ways in which your life needs to be regulated that you are going to be able to achieve that goal, achieve that end. That is not what the man-made law is about. It's not trying to get you to heaven, clearly. It's not, the natural law doesn't do that. You need to be told things that will direct you in the to achieve that goal. And that, of course, is what's at the heart of the Sermon on the Mount. You are being given instruction from Jesus. God made man about this is how you're going to live a life in which more and more God is at the center, and so therefore you would be inheriting him in eternal life. The second reason, certainty of command. In other words, laws can make mistakes. Laws can be fallible. So that you have a clear understanding from God about what is expected, how you're supposed to live. We need that. We need something that we can really take as an authority. And of course, the man-made law is not like that. One of the things that I really enjoy doing in the sophomore year is talking with them about Supreme Court decisions, and especially where Supreme Court decisions go awry. So think of Dred Scott. The black man has no rights which the white man must recognize. We all now recognize, you know, what a crime, in a way, the Dred Scott decision is. But that's the problem with the Supreme Court. It's the supreme law. It's the supreme interpreter. So you're stuck. You're stuck with it. There isn't any way around it short of overturning it at a later point. I also talk about Plessy versus Ferguson, right? This was the Supreme Court decision that upheld separate but equal. And that's what Dr. King and others were fighting during the Civil Rights Movement, where there was this principle of legal separation, segregation, that was upheld in a constitutional decision. So we need things that they really are good, and we know they're good, and they aren't fallible, and they aren't making mistakes. Again, all human authorities are like that. I'm not just picking on the Supreme Court. Interior movements. What is your motivation? What's in your heart? Generally, the man-made law doesn't address that. The man-made law is not addressing kind of what's going on in the inside. More often than not, it's addressing the action. Now, we can think of exceptions to that. I think of, for example, when you distinguish first, second, third degree murder. You distinguish these according to how much the action was premeditated. So you do have to determine some degree of responsibility. First degree murder, you thought it through. One of the shows that I loved growing up in the 70s was Columbo, Peter Falk. And I remember the whole thing about the show was that you saw the murder from the very beginning. So there was no mystery about who did it. You saw who the murderer was, always a celebrity, you know, who came in and murdered somebody. And the thing that was attractive about the show was how Columbo figured it out. But all of these were first degree, generally they were first degree murder. It was planned out. Occasionally you had a murder that was second degree, that was heat of the moment, that really was impulsive. And then what the murderer is doing is covering their tracks. So the murder may be, they're less responsible for the murder, but they are certainly responsible for obstructing justice, obstructing an investigation, concealing evidence, and those are all the things they're directly responsible for. So first degree, you thought it out, you planned it. Second degree, heat of the moment. The bar fight in Tijuana between Juan and Miguel over Juanita, right? That can be second degree. And then third degree, where there's some kind of culpable negligence. So vehicular homicide, when you're driving drunk or driving impaired, that generally I think is going to be third degree. Okay? So there are times that we talk about degrees of responsibility, but generally we are pretty focused on what was the action committed. And, you know, can you prove that this person did it? And even where we talk about intent, we need to be able to establish intent by external things. We can't read their mind. But if we find canceled checks early enough, or right, we can establish, oh, this was happening months before the murder and points to some kind of premeditation. As opposed to witnesses being able to say, no, there was no pre-existent hostility, they had both been drinking too much, and this is what happened, second degree. Or establishing this person needed to do something that they didn't do, or they did something that put them in a state of impairment, third degree. But generally, the law is not criminalizing what's in your head. And in fact, when we think of something that's a totalitarian regime, think of the old Soviet Union, where you could have crimes like anti-revolutionary thoughts, anti-social thoughts. You could be prosecuted for what was in your head. Somehow the state was so all-knowing that what was in your head could be criminal. And anywhere where you have a totalitarian society, you can be prosecuted for your thoughts. Go ahead.
We have hate crimes here in the U.S. Isn't that coming close to that?
But it depends on. So look, if I go in with spray paint and spray paint swastikas in a synagogue, they don't actually have to read my heart. There's something objective there. But I think what would be more like the equivalent of the worry that we could have in the United States. You are guilty of racism by being white until you prove otherwise. Remember that when we had civil rights cases in the 70s, one of the changes that happened under Congress that then the courts were enforcing was where you have unequal hiring or unequal pay, the presumption is that it's racist. And if you have unequal pay and unequal hiring among identifiable racial groups, racism is presupposed, and the burden of proof is on the defendant. The burden of proof, you have to prove you're not racist. And in fact, that was something that changed, I want to say, about 15, 20 years ago, where it restored the burden of proof to the accuser. You had to show that their motivation was being racist. But the for many years before that, no, if you are hiring this racial group more than that racial group, or you're promoting this racial group more than that racial group, the presumption is racism, and you, the employer, have to prove otherwise. So, in other words, there would be no other reason for the inequities unless racism was in your heart. Okay, there's no other reason for the inequities. So, and certainly when you have, I remember 5 years ago, was it 5 years? It was during COVID. I was doing a presentation to Providence parents about the church's teaching on racism. It was right after all the George Floyd hoo-ha. And I remember a number of parents who were telling me, I'm getting this at my work. I'm having these seminars and trainings where I'm being told racism is part of whiteness. Well, in a way, then what you're doing is, you may have some trumped-up sociological study to support that, but in a way, what you're doing is reading hearts. I know by you being white what is in your heart. Okay, I know. So I don't have to establish a track record of actions or words or by the very fact of who you are. Your heart is this way. Okay. Let me just do this one more, because this C is the one I'm going to spend the most time for. So the divine law provides for a supernatural end, certitude of commands. It actually is able to judge the heart. The man-made law is not able to judge the heart. But we do need some body of moral understanding which judges the heart. And that's what it is that the divine law does. So if you think about the Sermon on the Mount, you are getting a kind of standard to look at your own heart and say, I have done this for vanity, or I've done this to look good, or and that's something therefore that you're answerable to God. But the state can't or shouldn't punish you for what's in your heart. But if you have a bad heart, that does deserve punishment, not from the people around you. That is something for which you're answerable to God. And then finally, universality of punishment. Of course, the law can't punish all wrongdoing. It would be a really oppressive society if we had the state punishing everything that was wrong. There are all sorts of things. In fact, that's one of the beauties of the Scarlet Letter. You know, you're seeing a society in which almost they take the moral law and download it to the social law or the community law or state law. It becomes a very oppressive society. There are things that we allow not because they're good, but because we just can't punish everything. We don't want that kind of society. So, for example, there's all sorts of lying that white lies, lies in a pinch, that we let people get away with. But when it's fraud or perjury or slander, that directly impacts the common good. So we make that illegal. But there may be all sorts of other lies that we can't punish, don't punish, but ultimately should be punished. Okay? I'm leaving aside, by the way, all the ways in which people who are bad just don't get caught. One of my daughters used to watch Blue Bloods all the time, the Tom Selleck kind of cop drama. And one of their favorite lines out of that is where they catch people, and they make such bad choices. It just seems so stupid. But the police chief always says, "Well, you know what? If they were smarter, we wouldn't get them. You know, be grateful they were this dumb, and that's how they got caught." If you are a really smart and methodical criminal, it's going to be really tough to catch you. Think back to one of my favorite examples of this, the Unabomber. The Unabomber, that guy was so smart and so thorough. The only reason he got caught was because his brother turned him in. I don't think that guy would have ever gotten caught if it weren't for his brother. And even then, when the brother first tattled on him, the FBI didn't believe it. They actually blew it off. It took them a while to circle back and follow the testimony. Okay, so notice that when we are talking about the man-made law, we are aware that we're dealing with the limitations of fallible laws that are for a kind of natural social ends that punish in a limited way and mostly are based on externals. They're mostly based on what can we show that this person did. And even if we talk about intent, we still need to demonstrate something externally to substantiate the claim about what was in their mind. We can't talk about anything that's going on in their mind, really, without having some kind of external action to support that. Okay? So we have the state, therefore, making laws and making laws to enforce justice so that we can all live together and live together in peace. And so the first and primary people, therefore, in society that are enforcing justice are the legal system, our judges, our lawmakers, the executive authority. So what is it that makes for lawful judgment? First, that the people who are enforcing laws really do really are caring about judgment, about justice. In other words, they're not just doing this to hold on to their power. They're not just doing this to push people around. They're not just doing it to gratify constituency. Really, what allows the laws not only to be, but even be perceived as just, is that these are people who genuinely care about justice and they genuinely care about the common good. So that's what he means by the inclination of justice. Like, what's your motive? Where are you coming from? Okay. When Eugene Bull Connor is enforcing against protesters in Birmingham, parading without a permit, Dr. King in his letter is able to say, it is of course just that you require people who are publicly demonstrating to have a permit. That's a reasonable request. But when we're denied a permit, basically to stop any kind of First Amendment protest of segregation, that's where it becomes an unjust law. So it's not that the law requiring people to have a permit is wrong. It's where you're doing it to basically shut up the other side from this unjust law. Second, that you have due authority. You really do have the authority to make that judgment. You really are the person who has the purview over whatever that area is. And then finally, that you're doing it according to some notion of prudence. That you apply the law in a way that respects the common good. You can obviously have a law that's a reasonable law the problem isn't so much now the motive, but you apply it in a way that's unreasonable or hurtful or a problem. Okay? So we expect people to be making these kind of judgments. Now, Notice that it's very clear when you're talking about the secular law. It involves, are you a good or bad person? That's wrapped up with those kind of judgments. So, are you a murderer? Are you an embezzler? Are you have you been stealing? Have you been vandalizing? That all involves whether you're a good or bad person. So I think when we talk about judgment, we're not thinking about things like, for example, you are going to charge teen boys higher rates for car insurance than you're going to charge teen girls. You're not saying they're a good or bad person. You're saying teen boys have higher rates of property damage with cars than teen girls. By the way, they get this in driver's ed, so I'm repeating to you something I haven't substantiated. I hear from them. Actually, the young women get in more accidents than the young men. But they tend to ding things. They tend to like bump things or ding things. Whereas the guys, it's like they want to go out in a blaze of glory. They total the car. They T-bone the car at the intersection. That thing is just going. It's not going to be recognizable when they bring it home. Anyway, so insurance companies are not saying your son is bad. They're saying your son is a little more expensive. Like amortize, spreading out costs on average. Nothing against your son. He's more of a liability. Okay, so that isn't a judgment about good, bad. That there's no moral judgment that comes with that. I suppose you could say something about recklessness versus care, but on the whole, you're not saying bad boy, good boy, bad man, good man. The things that we care about really are moral judgments. And so where it is not something that where you have the authority, where you are not, in other words, forcing this for the sake of the common good, generally there isn't as much of a responsibility and therefore a place for you to be deciding who's good and who's bad. There are all sorts of practical things that you need to do. Your daughter brings home her boyfriend. You are looking this guy over, and you have to come to some kind of judgment. Is this something I encourage, or is this something I discourage? And all you can work with is externals. All you can work with is externals. That is not an unnecessary judgment. When you are thinking about the happiness of your own children, that's not an unnecessary judgment. But you realize at the same time that you're fallible, that you could be wrong, that, if you've been around long enough, sometimes you just feel like, I could be wrong, but I'm not. You aren't really able to make that qualification and take it very seriously. One of the things my father told me, I would have been an early teen when he said this to me. He told me, people are not wrong about each other. There are things that you pick up about each other, and you have to pay attention to those. And you don't even necessarily have to be all that old. There are things, even when you were a kid, that you picked up about other people. And he says, generally, the only times we're wrong is when we have a motive to be. The only times that we're wrong is when we have a motive to be. There's something about that person that we really like, and we just don't want to listen to the warning voice. Okay, so there are times that this isn't legal. This isn't something where we exercise some authority over these people. It could be over your kid when they're a teen. Yes, but it could be your daughter's 21 years old or 23. You're still using the X-ray treatment on the guy that she's bringing home. You're still doing a kind of a scan. That you do have to make some kind of judgment, because some way, even when your kid's a young adult, they are relying on you. They are relying on your experience and your insight. Even if they're not crazy about it, and even in fact they don't want to hear it, there is still something that they need to hear from you. So there is a kind of judgment that you make. So that brings me over here to point three, to private judgments. Because very often when we're talking about making judgments, that's the realm we're talking about. We are sort of on our own, dealing with life, having to figure out things about people. And so the first and most basic point that I'm making here is it a judgment that's necessary? There are all sorts of people in public life that just as they're in the news and we make judgments about it, that probably we actually don't need to. There's no particular reason why we need to say that that celebrity is a trollop. There's probably no particular reason why we have to say that coach is only in it for the money. We do that reflexively. We do it very easily. But unless it's necessary, there probably isn't really a reason to do it. And again, what you get in terms of your information through the press and the media, how reliable is that? You know, and that very often that's what you're going from. There's a great line in C.S. Lewis. It's in the Screwtape Letters, and that's why I made a note to myself there about it. This is in the very close to the beginning of the Screwtape Letters, and it's where he's talking about the patient. Patient has come back to the faith or come back to the church. And you would think these devils, well, I know our students, they read it and they, well, if the person converts and they come to the church, doesn't the devil just sort of throw in the towel at that point? No, no, no. There are so many things you can do with people in church. Your devil never throws in the towel, by the way. They're always like, I always think of the devil as being kind of like the Yankees in the ninth inning. You can be ahead of them like five runs, and they can have like this, you know, seven run rally. They're never out of it. They're like the vampire. You put the stake in at the end of the movie, and the very next movie, somebody pulls the stake out. So the devil never quits. Anyway, the recommendation that Screwtape gives is, you know, first, there are going to be all sorts of people in church that are distracting. So just encourage that distraction. There's going to be people there with funny clothes or squeaky boots, or there's going to be all sorts of things to annoy and pull them away from what's important. The example that I give when I talk about that, I used to be in a parish where there was this lady who was always three seconds behind on the prayers. And when you have that all the way through, everybody said amen. 3 seconds later, amen! Just like that. Yep, there's nothing evil there, but just keep that concentration up. There, I find at this point in my life, I'm actually not so much distracted by screaming children, because I'm just grateful it's not my kid. Yeah, the moment you factor out that, hey, I'm not responsible for that kid. Yeah, I actually start to smile a little bit. Yeah, so the second thing, there's always going to be some element of disappointment. You have this picture in your head of what church is like or what it will feel like, and you can build up a picture that doesn't quite fit your experience. I know for me, the example I always give, my knowledge of the Catholic Church, I know this is going to sound very odd, when I was a kid, I was totally into the Middle Ages. I was into castles and swords and knights and jousting, so my picture of the church was from like cathedrals and things like that. So the first time that I went to a Catholic church, and it was this pentagon-shaped room, and there was no art or anything. It was just these banners: love, peace, joy. Right? Remember the joke that, you know, the Protestant tells the Catholic, "You guys worship statues," and the Catholic says, "We don't worship statues. We worship banners." it was like that, and. And one of the, it was built, this is a retreat house actually, but it was the closest place to our house. It's built on a hill overlooking Anchorage, and one side of this church, it's all window. And you're like looking out at Cook Inlet. So it's almost like you're up in the, you almost expect like there to be a bar and some chairs, and bartender, when you go around, could you get another gin and tonic? It just looks, it has this just great distracting view. Anyway, there was just nothing about this that fit with what my picture of a Catholic church looked like. So that was really disorienting. That took a while. After a while, I did find a church that looked more like a Catholic church. So that was helpful. But here's the third thing. I have been writing hitherto on the assumption that the people in the next pew offer no rational ground for disappointment. Of course, if they do, if the patient knows the woman with the absurd hat is a fanatical bridge player, or the man with the squeaky boots is a miser and an extortioner, then your task is so much the easier. Okay? In other words, if you have people in church that they really are bad people, this is great. Because he can just look around, oh my gosh, that guy's terrible. And so she, you know, he can do that. All you have to do is keep out of his mind the question, if I, being what I am, can consider that I am in some sense a Christian, why should the different vices of these people in the next pew prove that their religion is mere hypocrisy and convention? You may ask whether it's possible to keep such an obvious thought from occurring even to a human mind. It is, Wormwood, it is. In other words, when you look around, again, the example that I use with the kids, I tell them, you may look around at this guy and you may think, that guy is totally into, he's a pothead. And there he is, right, in the front row. That girl over there, she is the total party girl, right? And here she is in church. You could just get the idea that, why am I even here? You know, these people who plainly don't even care about the moral life are here. Okay, you don't know that that guy who you just write off as a pothead, that he isn't just actually, he wants to quit. Wants to quit and doesn't know how. You don't know that the girl that you've just written off as the party girl, she is actually desperately unhappy and doesn't know how to get out of this crowd of people that she's in. That's the very thing about, right, reading hearts. You don't know what's going on. I had a very good friend in college. The first couple of years in college, he was like going to Los Angeles and living the high life. Very, very, very expensive drugs, not just drugs, very expensive drugs. But this was a guy that in the middle of sophomore year, boom, he comes back to the church with his girlfriend, hasn't gone to confession in about 2 years, goes to confession, and lives this really kind of rigorous Lent, turns it all around. In fact, these are the very kind of kids that you would think, why are they at Thomas Aquinas College at all? Why are they in this very conservative Catholic school? Answer, they wanted to change. They couldn't do it right away. They couldn't do it that first year. They couldn't do it at the beginning of the second year. But finally, it was like they couldn't fight it anymore. So you can see these people in church that there actually is some kind of interior struggle going on. There's some kind of interior war going on. In fact, it could be that's why they're there, but they aren't able to pull the trigger yet. They aren't able to make it happen. So that can be the importance of not thinking that the people around you who aren't living it it's just hypocrisy. It's just phoniness. Now, I'm completely aware of the modern situation in which not only do we have people who are living a, let's say, a bad life and going to church, but now they're very vocal about it. In fact, they're very vocal about the church being wrong. Okay? That's a different thing. Because now we're not talking about interiors anymore, are we? We are talking about things that are exterior and articulated. So in other words, if I'm going to church as a man in a gay lifestyle, and I'm very vocal about how the church is wrong about judging my gay lifestyle. Okay, we're not talking about something interior. We're talking about something exterior. So there are times that you need to address those things because they really are scandal. And again, let's all remind ourselves what we mean by scandal. Scandal doesn't mean, right? It doesn't mean you're shocked. In fact, scandal is obvious when you're not shocked. Scandal is where something has been a bad example long enough that it doesn't bother people anymore. They just decide this is okay. This is fine. It's not that big a deal. In fact, there's something that I learned about for the first time reading Robert Bork's book, Slouching Toward Gomorrah. This was the second book that he wrote years ago after he got borked. He talks about this thing called the Durkheim constant. So Emil Durkheim, the pioneer sociologist, came up with this. Once you have a form of deviancy that increases to over 5% of the population, what will happen is people will redefine that as acceptable behavior. Because generally, people cannot have more than 1 out of 20 people in their social circles be unacceptable. There's only so many people who can be unacceptable, who can be defined as abnormal. Well, at the point where immoral things become more and more normal, then that creates a lot of stress for people who are actually formed morally. So it could be that there are always some number of people that this is easier for them to navigate because they're cantankerous already. They're already a little socially prickly. So throwing out another five people on the average is fine with them. But for most, again, using the sociological term, most normal people, that's tough to do. That's tough to do. So what I'm pointing out here is that there can be the whittling down of judgment in a way that shouldn't happen. You should never be judging hearts. But if you feel like there are just too many people doing this thing for me to think the thing is wrong anymore, that's where the problem is coming in. That's where the problem is coming in. So it is true, probably we all struggle to some degree with making a judgment about a person when we really need to be more careful and say what they're doing is wrong, what they're choosing is wrong, and because we don't know everything that's going on inside them. But we need to be crystal clear about the action still being wrong, even when the actions become very common. So I think about, you know, our students, when I do the marriage and family unit, they don't have terms like living in sin or shacking up, or they kind of know the phrase cohabitation. But notice they've got this morally neutral phrase, cohabitation. If you were like growing up during the 70s, which was not exactly this era of conservatism and orthodoxy and morality, people were still talking about living in sin and shacking up. They were still using that language. Not so much because they were judging people as they wanted to make clear they were judging an action. They were judging an action that if you were a person doing that, you were making a bad choice. Now, it could be that I didn't get to all the things that you wanted to talk to about this. So if there are things about judgment that I didn't address, you want me to address, let's do that at the beginning of next time. Okay? Thank you.